He's able to sleep now. This overseer's meaner than the last. 5 stripes this time. She lightly wiped Gerasim's face with a damp rag. If he doesn't get back out to the field tomorrow, there'll be more lashes on top of these. I'll make sure he doesn't miss the morning bell. You need to get some sleep, too, Susette whispered as she unwrapped the rag from her pocket. I brought an egg and biscuits. Where is Solitaire?
Trying to hunt up some meat.
I'll be going to sit with Palmyra a little, then.
Move around careful, Elizabeth warned. Even Madame may not be able to help if the overseer finds eggs in your apron.
I'll say it's for the house. Suzette continued down the line of cabins in the quarter. Several men and women holding gourds waited their turn around the small handmill to grind their corn ration for tomorrow's dinner in the field. They stopped talking as she neared.
Good evening, Suzette said, slowing a little.
How is Madame?
One of them asked.
Still poorly, Suzette answered. Mademoiselle Aureline comes back to Rosedew tomorrow to stay until Madame is better, with her son.
The group nodded tiredly, and Suzette kept moving along the line of cabins almost to the end.
Young Clement and his mother, Eliza, ate their evening meal outdoors on the elevated porch of the cabin next to Palmyre's.
Suzette waved. Eliza was Suzette's age, and Philomène and Clement were inseparable whenever she allowed her children to come down to the quarter.
"Has Madame picked up any?"
Eliza called out.
"Still about the same,"
Suzette said in passing, and tried to continue on, but Eliza motioned her in.
"What's to come of us when Madame dies?"
the young woman asked with urgency, and although Clement sat quiet, he listened hard, as if Suzette's words could make the future.
No matter how many times someone asked Suzette the question, the pain was raw and caught her fresh.
She surprised herself with her outward calm, walking, talking, performing her chores, all the while on the edge of a consuming terror.
I don't know, Eliza. The talk is they will sell the place.
Can you say something about me and the boy going together? Eliza implored.
There's nothing I can do, Suzette said, turning away.
I have to see to Palmyra. No light came from her sister's cabin, no smoke from the chimney. A sadness engulfed the small dwelling, an emptiness that flowed from the inside out. The door was open, and Palmyra sat motionless on her pallet. Suzette almost expected to see Paul's chubby legs pumping as he ran to greet her, Soleil behind his older brother, and Mélantine in the corner, blowing bubbles to amuse herself. It had been 7 years since the children had been sold from Rosedew, and Suzette still thought of them as babies. They were as grown as her own too, and although she knew they were still on Cane River, they belonged now to some other place. Suzette walked over and touched Palmyra's shoulder. Palmyra looked up, lines etched deep in her forehead and around her eyes.
"You must eat, sister,"
Suzette motioned, and unwrapped the last of the biscuits and the other egg. She lit a fire in the fireplace and waited for the flames to take hold, gathering up Palmyra's small skillet and wooden plate. Suzette took the covering off Palmyra's weekly ration of bacon in the corner, cut off a small piece with the kitchen knife she brought, and put it in the skillet to fry. When there was enough grease in the pan, she cracked the egg and fried it up, too, and scooped it all out onto the wooden plate alongside the biscuits and molasses. She sat stiffly in Palmyra's pine chair, watching her sister listlessly swallow the food. When Palmyra finished, Suzette wiped the skillet and dishes as clean as she could, and the two of them sat in the childless cabin, wrapped in silence. Suzette finally got up. She needed to get back to the big house to make sure Françoise had not called for her. She touched the door and pointed out toward the moon.
"Tomorrow night," Suzette motioned to Palmyra.
Palmyra nodded.
No amount of punishment, reward, or deadening routine could ease the growing dread that reached from the big house to the quarter and into the fields. In more ordinary times, it was the season to be totally absorbed in the fourth and final picking of the cotton harvest and the brief sweet lull before the planting of the new crop. Instead, all hands waited anxiously for word from the big house. The overseer had lost some of his power to an even bigger terror, and the lash on the backs of the dispirited slaves now had the opposite effect of what he intended. The more he whipped, pushed, and demanded, the slower the tempo in the field became. The more hoes and pickaxes and oxen's yokes turned up mysteriously broken. The more twigs appeared in the swelling baskets of fluffy white at the end of each row of cotton. The questioning pop of the lash and the answering human refrain could be heard most days now as the overseer performed his work unchecked. In the big house, visitors still called, but their stays became shorter as Françoise became less responsive. Narcisse Frédieu was among those who came most often, and Eugène Dorat traveled sometimes by boat and sometimes by horse the 6 miles between Rosedew and the farm downriver he now shared openly with Doralise d'Urban. In the end, it was the women's job to tend to the dying. Suzette and Aureline often found themselves alone in the dark back bedroom with the weak, shrunken Françoise. Her skin had taken on a strange, translucent quality, and after long hours with no relief, Suzette sometimes believed she could see the blood straining to squeeze through the raised, rope-like veins of Françoise d'Urban's hands. "Have you talked to Monsieur Ferrier again?" Suzette began hopefully in a whisper, careful to tamp down any insistence in her tone. "Will he buy all of us together?" Aureline looked nervously at the supine figure of her aunt, who in troubled sleep drew ragged, raspy breaths. "This is not the time to discuss it," she whispered back. It was bad news. Suzette knew Aureline well enough to recognize when she was trying to avoid something she did not want to face. "But it will be your money when they sell Rosedew. It comes to you, not Monsieur Ferrier." "Sometimes I think I tell you too much, Suzette. Monsieur Ferrier is my husband. He is the one to take care of such matters. I have given you my word that we will buy both you and Philomène. He has agreed to that much. But he cannot see his way clear to buy Gérard. The boy is too young to be of the kind of help he needs in the field, and Monsieur will not move from his position. We are not rich. We only work a small farm, and we need someone for planting right now. Perhaps Eugène Dorat can help with Gérard. I can talk to him on your behalf." Suzette knew pushing any harder would force Aureline into defending her husband, taking his side against hers. She clamped down hard on her bitterness, as if it were a metallic bit set in her mouth. What kind of man needed to be shamed into buying his own son? "I would be grateful if you would talk to Monsieur Dorat, mademoiselle." Suzette busied her hands folding linen, letting time pass before beginning again. "Mademoiselle, if it's help with planting you're after, my sister Parmire can do the work of a man in the field. She's the strongest whole woman on Rosedew, and she can pick 200 pounds of cotton a day. Deaf and dumb doesn't stop her from being a good hand." "I can make no promises, Suzette, but I will try. I don't think you appreciate how much I've done for you already." "This isn't proper talk with my aunt in her sickbed. Let's hear no more about it." The days passed in dreary repetition, grinding down all three of the women in the back room, until Françoise began to use the short spurts of strength that came to her to fight against life. The curtains stayed tightly drawn at her request. She refused to sit up, and she choked on the food they brought to her bedside. After a time, she refused to eat or be fed at all, pushing away anything they brought like a petulant child. She slipped in and out of consciousness. The more Françoise's condition worsened, the less useful Aureline became, until Suzette was forced to take hold of the situation. "Mademoiselle," Suzette said gently but firmly, "you should send for the priest. She can't last much longer, and she would want to die in grace." "Oui," Aureline said. "Send Gérard for Father Blanc." The priest and Gérard returned together, Father Blanc on his chestnut bay, and Gérard on the Rose-Dieu mare. Still smelling of haste and horse sweat, the priest went directly into Françoise without stopping for his customary pleasantries, and set about the task of performing last rites. After he finished, they served him café au lait, and the three mourners waited respectfully for Françoise d'Urban's spirit to depart. When she neither died nor regained her senses, Father Blanc rode back to St. Augustine at a far less hurried gait than when he had arrived. And still Françoise hung on. Suzette thought it must be true what they said, Créole pas mourir, y dessèche. Creoles don't die, they dry up. Françoise d'Urban finally died on a Thursday, 2 weeks after receiving last rites, with Aureline sitting at her aunt's bedside holding her limp hand, and Suzette cleaning up after the mess of the attempted morning meal. It had taken Françoise a long time to die, just like her husband Louis. Unlike in life, in death she passed without drama or instruction. She just stopped breathing. Suzette said a quick prayer, made the sign of the cross, and got up off her knees. There was much to do. Her red-rimmed eyes burned and her back was stiff, the result of her having sat up most of the last 3 nights tending to Françoise, and she refused to embrace the sentimental scene of the niece's final farewell to her aunt. She let it pass through her without sensation, unwilling to be weighed down with the dead when the living were at risk. Her gingham dress clung to her, and her cocoa skin was slick, even more from the dread that had settled down deep within her than the familiar wet heat. "Mademoiselle Orline?" "Mademoiselle?" Suzette spoke to the pale, trembling woman in the same tone she had heard her father use when steadying a high-spirited horse, more importance in the tone and continuity than the words themselves.
"First we'll say a prayer for Madame Françoise together," Suzette crooned, "and then I want you to go to the front room and sit down while I take care of everything in here. I've brought your rosary. We'll send Gérard to fetch back Monsieur Doha. They know him well enough on Cane River. You don't even have to worry yourself writing out a pass. We should send for Narcisse Frédieu, too. You need family around you right now. Philomène will get you some nice sassafras tea while we wait for them to get here. We'll wait together. I'm still here, mademoiselle. Aren't I always here when you need me? Come on with me now. I'll take you myself and get you settled in the front room, and I'll be back to sit with you directly after I do a few things. You're a d'Urban, mademoiselle, and you can get through this. I'll help you."
Aureline offered no resistance, allowing herself to be guided toward the front of the house, away from the still warm body of her aunt.
"Look at those roses, Mademoiselle Aureline. Still pretty. Those flowers know how to keep on blooming year after year, whether they're looked after or not."
Suzette had cut some of the roses from the yard and arranged a cluster of soft yellows and salmons and reds in the cut crystal vase Louis had brought back from France so many years before as an anniversary present for Françoise. Even though Suzette had pulled back the heavy drapes at the window and thrown open the windows, the house still had the closed-in smell of infirmity and deterioration. She had spent each spare minute of the last few weeks cleaning walls, floors, and windows, bringing in pails of soapy water, as though by scrubbing she could hold back the moment when everything she held dear could be torn from her, the way she knew it had from so many others. Suzette saw Philomène appear silently in the front room, as if she had called out loud for her.
"Philomène, there you are. Go get Mademoiselle some tea, and send Gérard for Eugène Dora and Narcisse Frédieu. Madame has passed."
An unspoken signal passed from mother to daughter. "And make sure the news gets to the field that she's dead." Suzette kept Elizabeth's words in the front of her mind to keep herself from wavering.
You do whatever you can, whatever you have to, in order to protect you and yours. She knew the ones with last names could buy those she loved if they chose. Eugène Dora, Auréline d'Herban, Doralise d'Herban, Narcisse Frédieu. In the days following Françoise's last rites, the panic had come in waves, threatening to overpower Suzette unless she practiced her appeals over and over. She had repeated them to herself so many times that they chased each other around in her head, appearing in wake and in sleep in random order. She had begun to wonder if she would be strong enough now that the time had come, terrified that her pleas might not strike the right chords, that they would turn a deaf ear because she would sound as if she had forgotten her place. Would anyone else know how valuable they were? Her fiddler father, Gerasim, her deaf and dumb sister, Palmire, whose remaining senses allowed her to see her three children taken from her and sold, her clever Jérôme, who at the age of 11 already showed signs of being able to make anything out of wood, her mother, Elizabeth, whose breeding years were at an end, and whose tongue still stumbled sometimes over her French words, but whose cooking was second to none, and Philomène, her little Philomène with her thick wavy hair and creamy skin, who did not know how to bend enough yet, whose expectations were even higher than Suzette's own at that age. She needed more time with Philomène to get her ready. Leaving Philomène to watch over Orléans, Suzette hurried to the cookhouse. There would be many mourners visiting Rosedew today, and grief would not overpower the need for hospitality or nourishment.
Mère Elizabeth, I have to try to catch Monsieur Eugène and Monsieur Narcisse alone when they come. I'll send Philomène in to help with supper as soon as I can.
Elizabeth nodded, her face hard as she continued to stir the contents of the heavy iron pot suspended over the fire. Suzette picked up her skirts and ran to the front of the house to see if anyone had come yet. There were no horses. She hurried around to the back door and entered the house, passing down the hall to the front room, and motioned Philomène away from Orléans' side.
"Go down and help Mère Elizabeth," she whispered, "but be ready to be useful in the house, too."
"Yes, Mama," Philomène said gravely, and headed for the back door. Suzette took her position again in the front room with Orléans, and they waited. Eugène Dora was the first to arrive.
"Cousine Orléans," he said, arms outstretched as he strode in through the front door. "Françoise d'Herban was a good woman." Orléans held fast to him for a moment, and then they sat together on the settee. Eugène stayed close by her side for the next 2 hours. Shortly before supper was to be served, Eugène took up his hat to go outdoors for a smoke. Suzette followed him quietly, and when he stopped to light his cigar just out of sight of the house, she assumed her humble pose, eyes downcast, making small noises with her feet to let him know she was there. Eugène turned.
"Suzette?"
"Monsieur Dora, if I could just talk to you. You're a gentleman like Louis d'Herban was, and he freed his children. Look at what he did for Doralise."
It was the wrong beginning. Suzette knew it, but the words she had rehearsed were taking a crooked course of their own. She spoke in a rush, needing to get it out while she had this chance.
"Monsieur d'Herban recognized blood ties," Suzette said. "He did the right thing for his own flesh and blood."
She tried not to think of Palmire's children, sold one after the other by the widow d'Herban, because they had d'Herban blood. She circled Eugène quickly and dropped to her knees, head bowed, in front of where he stood. A small sharp stone cut at her knee, and she rocked herself on it to clear her mind.
"He treated you like a son. He would want you to look out for Jérôme and Philomène. He would say it was your responsibility, monsieur, please."
Suzette forced herself to stay on her knees, staring at the eyelets of Eugène Dora's shoes as she talked, willing the crisscross pattern of the laces to hold her together. Something dangerous and wild was threatening to lift her up, to set her clawing at the doll man's throat. Even through the material of her dress and undershift, she could feel the soft, warm pulsing and the stickiness around her knee, where the blood had been loosed. She ground her knee down harder on the rock.
Geron has been trained in the house. He knows how to be around people of quality. He's clever with his hands. He could help you around your own house or in your store. You've seen yourself how he can make tools out of wood and fix things better than grown men. If you don't step in, he could end up on the McAlpin place where they whip their Negroes into early graves. I'm begging. I never asked you for anything for myself. You can figure out a way to free him.
Suzette knew she had pushed in the wrong direction, but she couldn't seem to stop. It used to be that Eugène would make vague promises about freeing his children, but any talk of freedom now just set his jaw. She didn't have to see his face to feel the tightening of his body, like a cornered loggerhead turtle pulling its head into its shell.
"Or buy him for yourself. Save him. I'm begging you, save him. I'll do anything you want. Just don't let him be sold away from Cane River."
Eugène backed away from her, leaving her there, and turned to walk back toward the house.
"I'll do what I can for the boy," he said over his shoulder, and with quickened steps, he hurried away.
Even with her eyes closed and the stale taste of dust in her mouth, Suzette could still see the crisscross of his shoelaces, long after he was gone. Now Cease didn't arrive until mid-afternoon. Suzette listened for his approach and went out to him as he rode on to Rosedew atop his sorrel mare. He looked prosperous in his dark broadcloth suit and new riding boots. He had recently married and bought land downriver near the parish line, close to the farm where Aurelien and her husband lived. Suzette had been lent to both of them to cook and serve for their opening parties. This time, she promised herself, she would say the words as she had practiced them.
"Monsieur Narcisse, I am so sorry for the loss of your aunt."
In front of her was an aspiring young planter, sitting high on his horse in his stiff black jacket and tie. But Suzette could still see the pudgy little boy trying to order her and Aurelien around in the piney woods behind the big house. Suzette did not look directly at him.
"You know us here on Rosedew. You spent time in my mother's kitchen. She always thought high on you, more than any of the other cousins who came to visit. She always told me that you would make something of yourself, even when you were little. She knew you had a good heart, a kind heart."
The lies were second nature. They were expected and easily accepted.
"Our family was always faithful to the Derbans. My father was born here. My mother has been cook for 30 years. You must need good workers you know and trust. Take Elizabeth and Gerasim together. They would be grateful and work hard for you. You've tasted my mother's cooking. With Mademoiselle Tranquillin being so new to marriage, Elizabeth could help her get the house set up and running smooth. And Gerasim is a steady hand in the field. He handles an ox as well as he plays the fiddle."
Narcisse's heavy brows pushed together toward the center of his wrinkled forehead in a gesture Suzette knew well. He was anxious to get down from his horse and get inside out of the drizzle, but he was also drawn by the idea.
"Oui, Suzette, I know your family,"
Narcisse said uncomfortably. "But I can't afford to buy 2 more slaves now, no matter how helpful they might be."
"Monsieur Narcisse, they need to be sold together to a good place, the kind of place you would run. They've been together for over 30 years on Rosedew. Already they'll be separated from all of their children and grandchildren. They'd work harder if they were sold together."
"I can't go into debt trying to keep the two of them in the same place. It's likely they'll both end up on Cane River somewhere, and they can visit each other Sundays."
Narcisse spoke into the distance, as if Suzette were not standing close enough to the sweating mare to feel the heat pouring off her. Narcisse paused.
But I could use someone for the house who would give Tranquilin a hand with the cooking, he said, as if the notion had just appeared out of the sky. Just as quickly, he was finished with the subject. I need to go in to Cousine Aureline. See to it that someone takes care of my horse. He swung himself easily off his mare, splattering mud on Suzette's dress as his boots landed in a small puddle. He threw the reins in Suzette's direction without looking back and disappeared into the house. Suzette had wanted to do more than plant a seed with Narcisse Frédieu, but a seed planted was better than nothing. Suzette asked Aureline for permission to go to Mass the next morning to say prayers for Madame Françoise, and Aureline wrote the pass. Suzette set out on foot before daybreak to get to St. Augustine by 6 o'clock. Doralise d'Urban would be there, as she always was on Wednesday mornings. Suzette listened to the Mass from outside on the gallery. St. Augustine had risen in status since its struggling early years, and no longer allowed slaves inside the sanctuary for any reason. Doralise was one of the first out of the church. She looked calm and steady, older than Suzette remembered, with fine lines around her eyes, and the corset couldn't hide the thickness around her middle. But she was still the portrait of refinement to Suzette, and the few gray strands in her hair only made her more stately. Doralise might be colored, a woman and her marraine, but she was still one of the ones with last names. Suzette had to be careful. "Suzette!" Doralise said, surprised.
"Madame, I have come to see you," Suzette said. "Rosedew is finished, and they are going to sell all of us away."
Doralise reached out and touched Suzette on the arm, nothing more than a moment's contact. Suzette reminded herself that this was the woman now living with the father of her children. The words poured out too fast and hot and random.
"You're a mother. You understand. Have mercy on us. What if your daughter Elisada was in danger of being sold away from you and there was nothing you could do? You have a part in this family. They're planning to sell Gerasime and Elizabeth and Parmire and Afia and Solataire all to different places and our children somewhere else altogether."
Suzette took a deep breath. This was too important to let get away from her. The thought of the fleeting touch steadied her. Doralise was listening, even sympathetic. She began again.
"Mademoiselle Orline has promised to buy Philomène and me together. But that leaves Jérôme. Mademoiselle Orline can't get Monsieur Ferrier to buy in an 11-year-old boy. It's no use. His mind is set against it. If you or Monsieur Eugène could buy Jérôme, he'll be treated right. Monsieur Eugène told me he would free them both, but now he doesn't say anything at all except that the times aren't the same as they were before. Please, please, think about what could happen to my boy. Help Monsieur Doha do what is right. I talked to him already, but he didn't say what he's going to do. Jérôme could get sold away from Cane River."
Suzette began to sob.
"I don't have anything but my family, and now even my children could be taken away from me. Madame Doralise, if you help me now, I'll always do anything I can for you. Always."
Doralise shook her head slowly.
"I do not have as much power as you think, Suzette."
She reached out to her again, and Suzette felt the smoothness of the soft gloves wrapped around one of her calloused hands.
"But I will try to find a way to help. Now I must go."
With each step of the long walk back to Rosedew from St. Augustine, Suzette felt the tiredness spread beneath her skin and lodge itself deeper than muscle or bone. She had done what she could. Nothing was certain. Nothing was settled. Chapter 8. The girl came to Elizabeth one afternoon in the cookhouse. The wind had been howling for the better part of the day, an unearthly screeching sound that made Elizabeth restless.
"Ma mère Elizabeth, I cannot talk to mamma," her granddaughter began without preamble. "She is... Philomène paused and looked away. She is nervous again.
Then talk to me, Elizabeth said.
I've had two glimpsings. Philomène made the announcement as if this were an everyday occurrence. Elizabeth looked closely at Philomène, staring deep into the intensity of her buttermilk-colored face. She swiftly crossed to the door, leaned out, and spat in the dirt outdoors.
Tell me about both of them, quick.
Philomène sat in one of the cane-bottomed chairs, her feet swinging free, not reaching the floor. On wash day, Mama was telling me the story of her white dress in St. Augustine. I heard her voice. I saw the steam from the washtub, but all of a sudden there was a different picture in my head. It was like floating, being in two places at once. I was the one in the white dress, with flowers in my hair, and Clement and I were in front of a priest, grown. Heavy drops ran down the side of Clement's face, as if he just came in from working bareheaded in the sun. I thought maybe we were taking First Communion, the way that Maman did, but then this morning, the second picture came.
Go on, Elizabeth urged.
Clement and I are sitting inside a cabin, and each of us is holding a baby. Both the babies are the same size, and they are ours. I know this.
Elizabeth allowed herself to grin. That gives you meaning, bringing a child into life. It looks like you're glimpsing yourself some good.
Both of the pictures feel happy, Mamère, Philomène went on. But in the first glimpsing, Clement's hands are too big, thick and rough and bright white, and he has a long split up his back.
Were the pictures clear or dim? Elizabeth asked.
They came to me for a long time, Mamère Elizabeth. Long enough for me to study. Clement has those big white hands, and he looks scared. And I don't know why he isn't two pieces up the back. What could it mean? Should I tell Clement?
I don't know what each part means, Philomène. But at the heart, it seems you and Clement are going to have some life together. The rest will come to you in time if it's meant. Store away what you don't understand for now. As for Clement, what do you think will happen if you tell him?
He might turn scared of me, the way some people are, or nervous, the way Mama gets.
Have you told him about the other things you've seen?
Always. He listens and asks me questions like you. He hasn't been scared yet, but this time he's in the glimpsing. That never happened before.
Philomène pulled at her hair, coiling the tip of one braid around her finger.
You know, Mama doesn't like me to talk too much about Clement.
Philomène, sometimes Suzette gets beside herself over color. His brown doesn't make him bad, and your yellow doesn't make you good. Your Mama follows her road. Your path may be different. You go on and tell Clement everything you can. For as long as you can. See what he's made of. There are things so hard that they refuse telling. Not this.
What hard things, Mamère?
Elizabeth shook her head.
You glimpse the best that can happen to a woman, and it takes me back to the worst.
The worst? Philomène asked.
Elizabeth looked beyond her granddaughter's young face into the depths of her old soul eyes. She judged Philomène strong enough.
Other people can tell you that you're nothing, that you have nothing, not even your own flesh and blood.
Like Aunt Palmyre's children?
Yes.
The shrill wind dared Elizabeth forward. Before I came to Louisiana, I lived on a big plantation in Virginia, working in a big house there, too. That wasn't long past girlhood when the young master got to pestering me. He was older, and whenever his mother wasn't around, he came after me. I didn't want him fooling with me, but there was no need fighting. There's no winning against what white men take into their heads to do on their own place. So I became his thing when he wanted.
and it wasn't so long before I had a boy child. I named him John and just kept on. The boy had light eyes from the beginning, even when he was struggling just to keep them open. They made me laugh at this little person I had made. He was mine. Wasn't nobody else gonna claim a blood tie. The mistress turned against me then and whipped me for dropping the bread, for looking at her wrong, for anything that came into her head. But I still had my John. I loved that little baby, and at first I kept him with me whenever I could. It didn't take long to figure out whenever she saw me with him, it put her in the mind to reach out and hurt me, or worse, John. It made the mistress a little crazy to see that pale baby peeking out of those blankets or in my arms. I started to leave him down in the quarter then, looked after along with the rest of the babies by whoever could tend him. I got down there when I could, especially to nurse him. I got whipped for that too when I wasn't where they wanted me to be. The young mouser kept away from me for a while, and his mother got him married. But he still looked to me when he was feeling a certain way. I nursed John as often and for as long as I could. They said in the quarter that nursing kept you from the next baby. It worked. I didn't come up caught again until after John finished nursing. He was almost two. I had another boy, and this time the mistress and the new wife got together and said they were going to remove temptation. They sold me away from both my boys. I didn't have much time to get to know the second one. I named him Jacob. That name was in the Bible, too. John and Jacob. Elizabeth moved stiffly to the fireplace to put another log under the kettle. Philomen sat quietly until her grandmother started talking again. They sent me straight to Cane River from there, without giving me a chance to say goodbye, not even to my babies, although Lord knows they wouldn't remember me. They put me on a boat in the hands of a friend of the family and sent me to New Orleans. I'd already been sold to someone they knew here, to Louis Durbin's father, Pierre Durbin. Both of those were French Creole men you never knew, here and gone before you were born. I didn't know any French at all, and that's all they spoke. They put me in the kitchen because of my bacon in Virginia, and when old Pierre died, I got passed around to his son Louis and came on here to Rosedew. I was blessed to meet up with your grandfather Gerasim. Lord, that man had to be patient. I was so torn up. When the baby started coming again, I thought I couldn't have any more boys, but I loved my girls and watched them grow. First Palmyra, deaf and dumb from the birth, and special. Then Afia and your mother Suzette, and finally a boy, Solitaire. I got to be grateful for every season that passed and we were still together. I saw them all grow up, and now they're grandchildren. The Lord gives us what we need sometimes. Elizabeth managed a fragile smile. It never went beyond her mouth. I don't know what happened to either one of my boys I left in Virginia. They would be your kin, your uncles. You find all the happiness you can with Clement Philomen, and you bring us children when the time comes. Family stays family no matter where they are or who they are. I can see the truth of your glimpses. Go find the boy. Talk to him as straight as you talk to me. The assessors arrived in waves over the course of the next 2 weeks. They set about with great purpose, never alone. They came on horseback, riding the length and breadth of Rosedew on both sides of Cane River, first looking in this direction or that, taking out some metal instrument, consulting one another, checking and rechecking. Then, seemingly satisfied, they made marks in their books. They visited all of the structures on the plantation— the smokehouse, cookhouse, barns, springhouse, tool sheds, corn cribs, quarter cabins, marking them off, one by one. They handled each piece of equipment from the large to the small, inspecting the condition of the cotton gin and the grist mill,
or the balance of the weighting scales. They ran their colorless hands over the tools and the harnesses as if they were getting ready to use them, but they never did. Inside the main house, they went from room to room as if they were in pursuit of a secret, their boots tracking in mud from outside that Elizabeth knew either she or Suzette would have to clean. She watched them feel the smooth, dark mahogany of the armoire, count the bedsteads, eye the silver, and finger the intricate patterns of the fireplace mantels, all the while scribbling notes in their journals. They left the slaves for last as they tallied up the life of Louis and Françoise d'Urban, gathering them in early from the field one day before twilight, and instructing them to wait under the ancient oak at the edge of the big house. The spread and grandeur of the tree made them look small, old and young huddled together. They had been given double rations for the last few weeks, and the overseer had been ordered not to mete out any fresh lashes before the sale. The assessors worked from the inventory that had been taken 10 years before, after Louis d'Urban passed away. All they had to do was add the names of those who had been born in the last decade, and subtract those of the ones who had died or been sold since. They didn't have to guess at the slaves' ages again, or the spelling of their names. Not one new slave had been bought in the last 10 years. Times had been too lean. The assessors sat behind a makeshift table, four grim-faced white men selected with great care, whose job it was to estimate where the bidding should start for each of the lives passing in front of them. The slaves clustered together in their family groups, glancing over at the assessors behind the table with the big journal. Elizabeth and Gerasim formed the center of one of the groups, their children fanned out around them. Suzette brought out Geron and Philomène from the big house and took her place with her mother and father as they waited. Elizabeth's second daughter, Afia, held tightly to all three of her children. Led clung to her mother's dress, too old at 11 to suck her thumb, but mouthing the back of her hand. Afia carried infant Florénal high on her hip, and with her free hand held on to 3-year-old Euphémie. Solataire, Elizabeth's youngest, talked quietly to those around him. His wife and children were on the Grenot plantation, and Elizabeth knew he was praying to be sold there. Palmyre had come alone in silent surrender. Her three children had already been taken from her. What difference could it make what they did to her now? The assessors were ready. After conferring among themselves, they nodded to the overseer to begin.
"Get yourselves old to young. First man and then women. Old to young," the overseer called out loudly from behind the table.
There was confusion, as if they'd been torn apart from each other already. They looked to one another for understanding. This wasn't even auction day yet. The overseer moved menacingly toward the clumps of families under the oak tree. He caressed the coiled whip at his hip next to his flask, but did not remove it from its place.
"Are you deaf? Line up old or young. Don't force me to put you in line myself."
Gerasim was the first to understand. Elizabeth watched her husband as he moved quickly toward old Bertram, whose clouded eyes and swollen leg made it difficult for him to move. Gerasim led him slowly by the arm to the assessor's table, and then plunged back into the knotted group to find Athénase, the next oldest man on the plantation.
"He's just getting into a line for today," he said under his breath to everyone he passed. "And then you go back to your families."
They sorted themselves by looks and by remembrance.
"I was picking 100 pounds a day when he was still sweeping cow patties out the road," said one. "I'm older. I remember the drought of 22, said another.
All of the men went first, oldest to youngest. Then it was the women's turn. Only mothers with babies in their arms were allowed to come before the assessor's table as a family group. The process went smoothly, carefully, once everyone understood what was expected. A dollar figure was suggested and debated among the assessors. When they came to agreement, they marked it down in the book. a special notation was made for any defect, physical or mental. On auction day, it was honorable to provide full disclosure among gentlemen, seller to buyer, of any damaged merchandise. Elizabeth heard each of her children assessed, as well as herself and her husband. The overseer winked and smiled at his betters behind the table, proud to display his knowledge.
"A strong, healthy buck. Prime field, no injuries. Strong as an ox. No defects. No less than $1,500. He has the hernia. Pulls up now and again. Past prime, but useful to get others to work. With the fiddling, he should bring $1,200 to $1,300.
Auntie's getting slow, but good for the house and cooking. $800 would be fair.
Deaf and dumb, but you won't find a better with a hoe. The lash gets her attention if there's need. Bidding should start at $900. The uppity one is set aside, she and her daughter both.
The assessors kept steadily at their work until each one of the slaves was accounted for. They finished as the sun disappeared behind a dense thicket of pine trees to the west. The slaves avoided looking at one another after the inventory. They trudged back to the quarter against the murky darkness in silence, shoulders hunched and jaws slack. Even the children did not speak. They made fires and quickly prepared the evening meals. Some hardly ate at all, wanting just to go to bed and close their eyes until the morning light. Elizabeth and Gerasim lay down on their narrow pallet, pushed up against the far corner of their one-room cabin.
"We have dollars on us now," Gerasim said.
"We always had dollars on us," Elizabeth said.
"This is different. The sale is certain."
They lay on the pallet without speaking, Gerasim's chest to Elizabeth's back, his knees tucked up behind hers under the threadbare blanket. Finally, Elizabeth thought he had fallen asleep, until she heard his voice punch through the darkness.
"You've been a good wife. If we don't end up on the same place, I don't want another. I'm through, too. We made some fine children, wife.
We did, husband."
When the plantation bell rang out the next morning, they were still folded together in the same position. Chapter 9. Eugène Dora wiped at his puffy eyes. He had slept fitfully the night before, dreading the arrival of the second day of the auction, but he took his role as executor to the Rosedew estate too seriously to waver now. The day was cold and soggy, like his spirits. Rain had come down in sheets for most of the night, raising the river to dangerous levels and leaving the ground soft and yielding. The heaviest rain had eased its pounding after sunup, but already the day had seen several driving showers. Despite the weather, the turnout was a good one. Most of those who attended were locals from the different communities along Cane River who had known the Durbans. They came from Natchitoches, Cloutierville, Ile Breville, and Côte Joyeuse, but they also came from beyond Cane River, as far north as Compty, and as far south as Manette's Ferry and Point Coupé. There had been endless details to take care of, contracting the assessors, advertising the upcoming sale in the Natchitoches Chronicle for the required 30 days, and setting up the property for sale. Eugène had been consumed for weeks with preparations. Although he considered himself very capable in the art of trade, he had not felt up to the challenge of peddling human beings himself, so he had hired an experienced auctioneer from Natchitoches. There were 29 slaves to be auctioned off before the day was out, and his devotion to the memory of Louis and Françoise d'Urban obliged him to get the best price for each one. He had Solataire put planks down across the cypress-lined entrance of Rosedew to keep the wheels of the carriages and wagons from sinking into the mud, starting at the front gate and ending at the barn. Chairs and benches had been placed around the big house, but it quickly became clear that the day was so stormy they would have to squeeze into the barn. They crowded in as many chairs as they could, but there was only enough space for the ladies to sit. The opening day had gone as well as could have been expected. Rosedew itself, along with the house and all of its outbuildings, had been sold to Henry Herzog, a no-nonsense neighboring planter with a wide, solid face and stocky build. Eugène pulled out his watch. The auction was scheduled to begin at 3 o'clock, but people had started arriving shortly after dinner, coming early to get a closer look at whatever particular Negro they had in mind to buy, or to visit with the neighbors they knew would attend. Buyers and spectators exchanged pleasantries, waiting for the start. Everything was ready, except that Dr. Danglars had not yet arrived. If he didn't come soon, they would have to begin without him. The sooner the auction got under way, the sooner it would be over. Eugène kept to the front of the barn near the partially open door, where he could view both the packed tight crowd inside and any late arrivals. Women and men formed separate groups. Several branches of the Rachals were represented: Emmanuel Rachal from Cloutierville, and Antoine Rachal from Ile Brevel, from the white side of that family, and Jacquette Rachal from the free colored. The widow Grenot sat and chatted with Aureline and Tranquillin, Narcisse Fredieu's new young wife. Eugène noted that Henry Herzog had not come back for the second day, although his brother Hippolyte stood with a small clump of men that included Narcisse and Joseph Ferrier, Aureline's husband. Doralise and her married daughter Elisida stood off toward the back of the barn. Doralise was stone-faced, hard-edged, and detached, and Eugène was careful not to exchange glances with her in this mixed crowd. Dr. Danglars made a noisy arrival through the open front gate, his horse's hooves drumming against the wooden planks and churning up sodden clods of mud. Eugène went out into the light rain to greet the doctor, helping him dismount. Eugène did not want to go back into the barn, but knew that he must. The barn had the dank, sour, damp smell of decomposing hay, wet horseflesh, and bodies packed too close. Eugène escorted the doctor to the back of the barn, weaving past the seated ladies and the groups of standing men. They stepped behind the quickly erected barrier of corded hay, where the slaves waited. Old Bertram separated himself from the others and stepped forward. Dr. Danglars gave old Bertram a tight-lipped nod. "I do not forget how you looked after me when my father died," he said. Eugène looked behind old Bertram at the Rosedew slaves gathered, some looking frightened, some dazed. Pressed close together against the side wall of the barn were Suzette, Geron, and Philomène. Geron was his only son, Philomène his only daughter. The boy had Eugène's small ears and a sprinkling of freckles across the bridge of his nose. Suzette had called Geron clever with his hands, and it was true, the boy had a gift. He could work with wood, carving complicated and pleasing shapes, as well as figuring out how to take odd pieces of wood and put together a chicken coop, carve a butter paddle, or craft tools. But he always seemed withdrawn and shy. Philomène was another matter entirely. Eugène found his chestnut-haired daughter unsettling, sometimes even frightening. Philomène's jaw, when she concentrated, set along exactly the same lines as those of his mother's. Her long hair was a springy explosion around her head, making her look too fierce for a 9-year-old girl, and her eyes were hard and flat. Eugène pulled Suzette to the side. Keeping his voice low, he told her, "I will be buying in Geron." Even as Eugène saw the relief catch hold in Suzette's face, Philomène dropped Geron's hand, stepped over to them, and motioned for Eugène to stoop so she could whisper in his ear. "My name is Philomène Dorat," she said in her high little girl voice. "I already saw you choose Geron instead of me to live with you." She swallowed hard and went on. "And you will leave all of us in the end, even Madame Doralise." Eugène stared at Philomène for a long moment as if frozen, and then took Dr. Danglay by the sleeve and walked him out toward the front of the barn. Suzette was too meek to put the idea into Philomène's head that the child could take his last name. Where had that come from? And those other things she said. He would never leave Doralise. He didn't know what to make of this strange girl, his daughter. Eugène had not planned it to turn out this way. At one time, he had really meant to free the children, but Gérard and Philomène had seemed to be doing just fine on Rosedew whenever he visited, and the years had slipped past. He had been preoccupied with his own affairs and his obligations to the widow d'Herban. But he did think about them. He did bring them gifts. Gérard would accept them shyly, but Philomène would reach out for them without hesitation, as if they were her due. By the time he looked seriously into what it would take to give them their freedom, the rules had changed. The laws discouraged even his inquiries. If he could get around the new decree that slaves could not be freed until they reached the age of 30, they would still revert to being slaves if he did not move them out of the state within 1 year. And even if he managed to buy them and take them out of the country, what would he do in France, starting over again with 2 mulatto children? How had everything become so complicated? Eugène settled Dr. Danglay into the front of the crowd and gave the auctioneer his nod to open the proceedings. They brought old Bertram out first. There was a carnival tone in the air. Auctions were serious business, but they were community entertainment as well. Social gatherings, not to be missed. A few of those in the barn looked away discreetly as Afia pleaded for her daughter Led, sold away to a planter from upriver. When Amandie, a man who could lift a 200-pound bale of cotton, began to sob loudly as the mother of his children was loaded into a wagon, leaving him behind, many in the crowd were unmoved. It was business. It was necessary. Mothers and fathers were the most likely to be separated. Brothers and sisters were sold in different directions. Sweethearts could only hope they would still be within walking distance of one another. The spectators embraced what they considered to be the kindnesses of the day. Mademoiselle Landry buying Dick and Lucy as a pair. The benevolence of Joseph Ferrier and his wife, Orline, taking in the cook's daughter, and one of her children and her deaf-mute sister as well. Old Dr. Danglay buying old Bertram, long past his prime, for his own house. Jacques Tessier buying Elisa and her son Clément together. Monsieur Plaisance buying Auntie Jeanne, close to 80 and nearly blind, for $25, just because she had been his wife's wet nurse. The auction was considered a success. All of the slaves were sold, most above the opening bid. There was a brisk market for slaves in 1850. Once the bidding started, bargains were quickly struck, money changed hands, mortgages drawn up, payment schedules arranged. Eugène signed off on the proceedings and gathered together the papers sealing all of the transactions of the last 2 days. The estate of Louis and Françoise d'Herban was officially dissolved. For a long time, Eugène Dora and Doralise d'Herban both pretended they were asleep in their bed that night, not touching, facing opposite walls. Neither wanted to talk about the day. Gérard was spending his first night away from Rosedew, sleeping in the back of Eugène's storeroom. He was their new houseboy and would help in the store. Doralise had taken supper out to him earlier and stayed away talking to him for quite a while. When she returned, she was unsociable, with few words for Eugène, and she went to bed early. Cane River Society had considered Eugène an eligible suitor when he first arrived among them, and he had been thrown together with any number of acceptable and available Creole daughters of French planters. Instead, he was living with Doralise, a free woman of color who filled his days and frequented his dreams at night. Doralise d'Herban, with her smooth hazelnut skin and dark, silky eyelashes.
He would have married Doralise if he could, would have made her Doralise d'Urban Dupré Dora. But that was against the law, a white man and a free woman of color. Like was only allowed to marry like, white to white, or free color to free color. Mixed could only pair up, and they paid a heavy price for their defiance. But he wanted her so badly that he had bribed the courts to grant her a divorce from her crazy husband, a Jean de couleur libre, who had tried to kill her with a knife one morning as she was fixing his breakfast. And he went down to the courthouse again to gift her his land and his house, to convince her just how sincere he was. His white neighbors were not as friendly as they had been to him before he moved Doralise into his house, and he could not take her into the homes of any of his white friends or relatives, but they had an active social life among the gens de couleur libre. At last Eugène heard soft breathing that signaled Doralise had fallen into a disturbed sleep. The entire business with the sale had created a strain between them. The few times they talked about his children openly and frankly, she seemed disappointed in how he discharged his responsibility toward Geron and Philomène. Doralise reproached him now, even in sleep. Each time Eugène closed his eyes, he saw a vivid picture of the three of them in the dripping rain that afternoon. Suzette was mouthing words he could not hear as she clutched the two small figures gathered in her skirts. Gérard's tears mingled with the drizzle, his mouth open. Only Philomène was dry-eyed, staring openly at Eugène with a look he could neither identify nor erase. Unable to lie still any longer, he got up from the bed and found the papers he had left on the table. He had already started to prepare one of the duplicates he would file with the courthouse, copying out in his cramped handwriting his day's work. The weight of the single page of the original record felt insubstantial as he held it. He would have to prepare yet another copy tomorrow before he was finished with his business, before he could place this one with all of the other plantation records, signifying the end of Rosedew. The room was too dark for him to read the ink on the page. He didn't want to light the lamp and disturb Doralise, and he could recall each entry from memory anyway, each transaction a permanent part of him now. Eugène ran his fingers across the page, guessing at the areas toward the bottom, on the paper that contained the names of his children, the lines that described their individual fates.
Chapter 10. The longing for each member of her family had become as real to Suzette as the flesh-and-blood people themselves had been, and thickened the black fog that surrounded her in her exhaustion day and night. The Ferrier farm was much smaller than Rosedew, but there was only Ferrier, Aureline, Palmyre, Suzette, and Philomène to bring in the crops and keep the household running. Suzette performed mechanically, doing whatever was expected of her, struggling to get up and begin each new day. Her family had been divided up among seven different plantations along the 19-mile length of Cane River, scattered like the fuzzy dandelion wishweed she'd dreamed on as a child. When she was young, she would close her eyes and make a wish, and then bring the flower up to her mouth to blow the seeds away, giving them up to the capricious winds to find their own direction. After 2 years on Ferrier's farm, she trampled the weeds under her feet without even seeing them. One muggy Wednesday, wash day, Suzette and Philomène were alone at the bend of the creek that twisted behind the farmhouse. "What's wrong now, Maman?" Philomène asked, worry flooding her smooth, buttermilk-colored face. She had the washboard pressed firmly between her knees, scrubbing at a dark jam stain on the tiny beige dress that belonged to Aureline's daughter. How could Suzette tell Philomène that as a grown woman of 28, what unsettled her most about the shape her life had taken was the absence of the everyday scent of her own mother, the easy knowledge that her family was within her reach? Sometimes, when she was preparing dinner for everyone on the farm, She half expected to look up and see Elizabeth, wrist deep in flour, giving form to a pie crust.
"I miss my family around me," was all Suzette could manage.
"I'm right here, and so is Aunt Palmyre. Geronte isn't far away with Papa and Madame d'Oralise."
Suzette winced, the word like a blow. When the girl first started calling Eugène Dorat Papa, Suzette had made her go out and pick a peach tree switch from outside the cookhouse on Rosedew. She'd whipped Philomène until her legs bled, but no matter how many times she had tried to teach her, it had no lasting effect.
"What have I told you about that word?" Suzette snapped. "There's nobody here but us, Mama," Philomène said defiantly. "You go looking for trouble in the wrong place with that talk, and they'll give it to you."
"I am Philomène Dorat, and he is Papa."
"Hush! I do not have the patience."
Suzette began to hum. When the longing came down on her, like today, she would make up melancholy tunes. The off-pitch notes helped her to stay connected, at least for a while. It was almost like being able to talk to Elizabeth, reaching back along the chain, touching her mother's spirit and the spirits of those she didn't know who had come before.
"We see ma mère Elizabeth on Sunday," Philomène offered, as if sensing her thoughts.
"And Geronte. That will make you feel better."
"Family is everything, Philomène. Don't ever forget that. A tree without roots cannot survive."
"Can I carry the past Sunday?"
"Just do your work,"
Suzette instructed, but the girl wasn't silent for long.
"What is it like in the field?"
"I pray you never know.
It looks harder than housework."
"That's trying to measure standing against stooping. Both aim to grind you down," Suzette said tiredly.
Suzette had spent her life on Rosedew, standing indoors and outdoors, standing in the presence of white folks, waiting for them to decide what she needed to do for them next. The only time she was permitted off her feet was when she was down on her hands and knees scrubbing, or on her back, in secret. She was on call to any number of mistresses or masters, snatching a bite to eat whenever she could, waiting for the whim of the next white person of any age who crossed her path. "See this burn?" Suzette stepped back from the clothes soaking in the tub and thrust out her left hand. "From pressing damp clothes with the hot irons." She pulled up her sleeve. "This one here? From putting out the grease fire before it could spread. Your mère Elizabeth has a quarter moon burned into her arm from a kitchen scald, just like she had been branded. Sometimes I can barely catch my breath at night after standing over the smoky stove all day. My bad shoulder was sprung from carrying firewood, or toting water, or lugging clothes back to the house. Who knows which? Now each harvest my fingers split from picking, and nothing can take away the headaches and back pains from stooping in the cotton field all day with no shade."
"Clément goes to field and doesn't get a headache," Philomène said. "Clément again," Suzette said. "How would you know about Clément's head?" "Madame d'Oralise. We tell her our messages, and she passes them back and forth between us."
"You need to put that boy out of your mind," Suzette warned.
"When we get older, I'm going to marry Clément," Philomène declared.
"Hush that talk! There is no future there! You're too young, and the brown-skinned boy is all the way over to Monsieur Tessier's plantation."
Philomène tipped the dirty suds water out of the tub and began to refill it with river water from the wooden bucket. She changed the subject.
"When I carry water out to Monsieur Ferrier and Palmyre, they go down the rows one after the other, Palmyre ploughing and Monsieur Ferrier dropping the seed."
"Monsieur Ferrier never owned house or field before," Suzette sniffed. "Owner of a farm not even big enough to have a name of its own."
"Is Madame Aureline still quality?"
"She has come down since Rosedew, for a fact. But she is still a Derban. At least Monsieur knows better than to let her do her own laundry. And he stays up to the farmhouse at night and leaves us alone.
Could be worse.
Maman.
Suzette looked up, alert. Philomène had slipped into the coldness of her glimpsing voice.
I'm here, Suzette said carefully.
It will be all right, Maman. One day we will all be together again. I see it, Philomène said, her voice flat.
From anyone else, the reassuring words could be dismissed as an idle comment, a hope, or a comforting daydream. Philomène did not deal in any of those realms. Sometimes the girl knew things with certainty. She had seen the fox get into the henhouse 2 nights before they lost 2 of their best pullets. She had pinpointed the exact location where the mudslide would bury an ox cart 6 months before it happened. Those hard, dry eyes hardened. Her mouth would tighten, starting at the jaw, and she would announce something whose time was not yet here.
What do you mean? Who will be together? Suzette asked softly.
Philomène straightened up from over the washtub as she wiped her hands on her apron, eyes barely closed, concentration etched in her face.
I can see us inside a house, in a room filled with people, she said. Like a dining room. Not here. Not rose dew.